Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me is returning co-host, John Siracusa.
I'm excited to be back. I read another book, sort of.
Well, you know, this time I tried to pick a book that I thought, surely John had read this book, and it turned out, no, he had not read this book. So this is your first time through Edward Abbott's Flatland.
Yeah, it turned out to be a trap, too. You said, oh, it'll take you 30 minutes to read. That is not true, ladies and gentlemen.
it's a thin book.
It is not a 30-minute read.
Okay, well, maybe I'm just used to reading faster than you are, I guess. But I'll grant you this. If you get the Dover Thrift Edition, it looks deceptively thin. I actually was reading it in Kindle this time, and it seemed longer than I remembered it to be. So I pulled down my paperback copy, and I realized that the Dover Thrift Edition uses like 9-point text through the entire thing.
Single-spaced, yes.
Single-spaced. So anyway, this is by Edward A. Abbott, who, if you don't know this book, Flatland, you don't know the name Edward Abbott, because this is the only thing he's ever been remembered for, and it was published in the 19th century. Edward Abbott is not a mathematician, or was not a mathematician. He was a Shakespearean scholar and the headmaster of a school, apparently. That's what I've been told, and I have no reason to disbelieve it. And so this was your first time through reading Flatland. And you have you ever seen references to this anywhere?
Certainly. In fact, I wasn't entirely sure that I hadn't read it, because it's so prominent in my mind as a thing that exists in culture and that is referenced everywhere. And I thought I knew the main conceit of the book, and I basically did. But once I started reading it, it became very clear to me that I had never actually read this before. I can imagine it being assigned in school as one of those things. Certainly it fits the bill, especially since it's like, it's really old, and this is the one thing the person is known for, and it has a mathematical angle to it. So I can see it being assigned, but I can say this, having read this for the first time now, had I been assigned this in school, I would have been very angry.
You would have been very angry,
yeah,
really.
And I know that because as an adult who is much more patient and able to deal with unpleasant experiences, I was angry reading it as an adult. Mostly angry at the author across time. But if I had been made to read this when I was in high school, I would have just, I don't know if I would have made it through, honestly. I feel like I might have bailed in the middle and just read the Cliff Notes or something, because the first half to three quarters of this book was trying to kill me.
Well, I had no idea I was inflicting such pain on you. This book is generally regarded as a light romp through spatial concepts.
If only.
But actually, no, it isn't. It's a strange book. It's a very strange book. If you know it, the first time I was ever aware of this is there was an episode of the original Cosmos with Carl Sagan in which he spends a lot of time discussing the basic two-dimensional conceit of this book. He gives Abbott credit. He talks the sequence that probably everyone remembers from this book, where a three-dimensional being comes into Flatland and tries to convince the two-dimensional narrator of the book that there are more dimensions that he just is unable to perceive, and uses that as a springboard to talk about multidimensionality in general. Sagan goes on to talk about tesseracts and about the theories of higher dimensions than the third. But that's a very small part of this book.
And I probably saw that, now that you bring that up. Like, that's why I probably feel like I must have read it, because that section, I probably saw it in Cosmos a long time ago, and it's referenced in parody and lots of other pop culture. And if that's what this book was about, diving into that or sort of a literary expansion of that, fine. But that is only a small portion of this book.
Right. So this book is titled A Romance in Many Dimensions. It is about a narrator, a square, who spends probably the first two-thirds of the book not giving any kind of a story, but instead giving a sort of an ethnography and a history of this mythical land of Flatland, and describing in painstaking detail not just what it means to be flat. You know, those are the things I think that are easier for a modern reader to get into, like these, the sort of the mental gymnastics about what it would mean to actually live in two dimensions. But he spends a lot of time talking about the society of Flatland, about the class structure of Flatland, about sexual politics of Flatland, about how there was a time in which Flatlanders painted themselves different colors, which led to a terrible revolt because nobody could tell anyone apart. So if you don't have patience for that sort of thing, which I gather you don't, it will be very hard to make it through the first part of this book.
Well, there's two aspects of that. One is if something is commenting on, satirizing, or whatever, a structure that you're not familiar with, it doesn't work as well. So if you're not familiar with whatever Victorian English class structure that they were trying to parody and stuff, it's not going to, like, the social commentary isn't going to land with you. So that's, you can set that aside. But if it had been done in a way, I'm not even going to say in a skillful way, I'm just going to say in a way that is more palatable to me as a modern reader, I would have been able to deal with it. But like what the writing style and the narrator and everything about it reminded me of, I don't know, even know if this is intentional or not, is like when we see modern, books, movies, anything, where they have someone sort of in this time period, an English person in this time period, and it's a character who loves to hear themselves speak and likes to sort of expound on their area of expertise or knowledge at great length, boring everyone around them, and they just love to hear themselves talk, and they go on and on, like usually presented for humor value, you know, like in a Jane Austen book or something. Like, that's what this was like, but I don't think that was the intention. I don't think the intention was, look at this blowhard, or maybe it was. Maybe I'm missing that part of it too, but the bottom line is, reading it is just very dense and very sort of detailed and self-satisfied and pompous and condescending and just like it just went on and on. Like I couldn't like read it quickly. It wasn't like a skim type read. It was very in-depth and the sentence structure was very convoluted, and it was a narrator that just clearly loved to hear themselves talk about all this stuff. And then on top of that, now I'm reading all this stuff and I'm thinking, I have that modern dilemma that I think we've discussed in the show before, like, am I supposed to am I on the same page as the person writing this? Because they're coming from a different perspective than I am. So when they describe this thing that seems awful to me, does it also seem awful to them? And therefore this is, you know, shining a light on the dark corners of their society and culture and showing how bad this is? Or is this one of those incidental things that seems awful to me as a modern reader, but was not given a second thought by the author because it's really not the point of the book. It's just incidental, but it seems terrible to me. And like throughout the entire part, it was like, surely some or maybe most or even all of this is social commentary, but I couldn't tell which parts. Like I couldn't tell if they're, you know, the exaggerated social structure in this two-dimensional world had analogs in the society it was written in, or some parts of it is just like, well, of course everything's like this, but then here's this terrible thing, and look at the terrible thing, and don't you see how I'm pointing out the terrible thing in our society, but of course everything else is just normal. And I couldn't make the distinction. So here I am wading through this, you know, incredibly dense, annoying prose with no characters and no plot to speak of. It's like reading a history book of things that never happened, written by someone who is not a very good writer. And so that's why I felt like I was just drowning, and it was taking so long to get through, and I hadn't even gotten to any of the parts that I thought the book was going to be about at that point, except for a brief mention of two-dimensionality and the various aspects of feeling and seeing and stuff like that. And even that part, I want to get to the math part in a little bit, but to begin with, like, that was my impression of the non-math geometrical portion of it. Did you find that to be your experience from reading that, or were you just sailing through?
For me, I would say there are two there seem to be two sources that Abbott is drawing from. He's drawing from the immediate source of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, which had come out just a couple of decades before and was a huge success and created something of a vogue for these kind of light fantasies that delved into logical problems and into, you know, sort of existential questions of reality. You know, they can be taken on one level as just sort of light flights of fancy, and they can also be used by people who are the kind of annoying smartasses who like to put up the pictures of Einstein sticking his tongue out in their dorm rooms to blow the minds of squares,
so to speak. But not from the foundation of modern science, though. So again, we're reading these things, but we know how incredibly wrong-headed their view of so many things are. But they didn't know that then, so you have to just get in that mindset.
To be fair, this book is about math, but it's about a very specific kind of math. It's about Euclidean geometry, which is its own thing. And in American math classes, if you go through high school, you know, you typically will have, like in freshman year, you'll have algebra, and maybe your sophomore year, you'll have geometry. And then by junior year, you'll have trigonometry and pre-calc. And at that point that you introduce trigonometry back into things, it sort of muddies the waters, because traditional Euclidean geometry did not have all the little niceties that we associate with, like, Cartesian geometry and with trigonometry. It didn't have, for example, measured angles. It was like there were rules about what parallel lines did, and there were rules about what right angles did, and you weren't really supposed to measure angles because that was seen as cheating somehow. So this is kind of like going back to a very classical source of math. So make of that as what you will. I would say the other thing that Abbott is drawing on very strongly is Jonathan Swift and that sort of Swiftian satire of de Gulliver's Travels, the idea of examining the cultural foibles through these crazy, exaggerated, mythical other worlds. And I don't think he's as good a writer as either Lewis Carroll or Jonathan Swift was, but I think that's what's in his mind. And I think that it was much more in the minds of Victorians who were reading this book than it might be in the minds of a contemporary reader.
Well, the big missing ingredient is a story. So Lewis Carroll or, you know, Gulliver's Twist, like they have all that social commentary, but there's also characters in a story to bring you through the social commentary. This has no story in the beginning.
But have you actually read Jonathan Swift? Because you can go long, long pages and there'll be just descriptions and not not story for many, many passages.
Yeah, but not a half to three quarters of the thing, though. Like,
yes, but that's a much bigger book too. Yeah. Anyway, but yes, I understand where you're coming from, and I also understand that it's difficult to tease out the satire in this book. I mean, one of the things that's a really big sticking point of this book is in Flatland, there is this very strange gender dynamic where all males are some form of polygon and all females are straight lines. And because the females are straight lines, they pose a threat to males whom they can pierce by bumping into them. And they are also presented in the book as shrill and unintelligent and given to sudden changes of mood. And this is an interesting point to tease out because of what you said about how it's hard sometimes to know, reading it from a modern standpoint, what we expect and what people of the time expected, because we actually have a little clue here. The second edition of this book had an introduction by the author addressing the fact that people had been complaining that the narrator of this book was a woman hater. And he said, you had to understand that the narrator was writing from the standpoint of a polygon of his class in his country. And then he has this line, he says, until very recent times, the destinies of women and of the masses of mankind have seldom been deemed worthy of mention and never of careful consideration. He's taking to task, like, actual history is being written this time, saying maybe the narrator is a misogynist, but so is, like, every other book out there right now. But I don't know that that exonerates him, because this story suffers from... several people have brought this up. I remember the guys of the Flophouse talking about this. It's like in Zootopia when you have this allegory for racism based upon carnivores and herbivores. And it's a terrible analogy because animals actually are in conflict. Actually, some animals do eat other animals. And trying to put that into some sort of an analogy for the way that humans mistreat various ethnic groups
within the same species, not like cross species, and to establish a sort of a natural order or obvious differences, and then say, but don't give into that, let's paper over it, versus a situation where we're literally all the exact same species,
right,
and doing terrible things to each other, like basically giving in to the premise that granted we are fundamentally different but we should get along, which is not the way to go.
The trouble with this story is he made the women straight lines and he mm-hmm. made the men all polygons. So,
right, it's not just like, see, that's the thing. Like the class structure of like how many sides you have and the lower classes and the upper classes, like I can, my vague knowledge of the past can say, okay, I understand that, you know, especially in England, the class structure and the sort of the social mobility and the problems related to that. But the women thing is like, they're just lines, right? And there is debate about the lines, something like, it's not even worth it to educate the women because they can't handle it, so don't even bother. But some people say that if you don't educate them, then they can be volatile and kill you. And the fact that they are deadly could be a commentary on, like, you know, misogynist views of women as, like, the source of temptation and strife, like, you know, basically mapping all of the failings of men onto the women that are evil and tempting them. But again, in the end, they are physically lines in this world. And if there was that kind of fundamental, I mean, and you can't tell, are they trying to say is like, of course we all recognize the fundamental difference that, you know, in real life, men aren't polygons and women are lines, but they might as well be because they're so incredibly different. Am I right, guys? Right? But then on top of that, the mean angle is like, oh, they're terrible and shrill and we shouldn't educate them when they're like, you know, domesticated animals. And so we don't like that. But of course, we all agree that the fundamental difference. Like, so I feel like the line versus polygon is the base level of unconscious misogyny that upon which he builds his social commentary about you shouldn't be mean to women because they're people too.
I think that the gender politics in this book are very strange. And at worst, the author is a misogynist. At best, he's very confused about what he's trying to say. I don't know what to make of that. I do kind of like all the craziness about the class structure based upon how many sides each polygon has and the regularity of those sides. I find that kind of funny because I'm married to a Platonic
to a multi-sided polygon.
No, I'm married to a professor of ancient Greek philosophy, and of course the Platonic ideal of forms is where my mind goes when I think about this, and I think about Pythagoras and Euclid and this idea that they're, you know, that the more regular something is, the more perfect it is, and the ideal of reaching for this absolute perfect geometry, and to see that actually play out in a novel, you know, it makes me chuckle a little bit, a sensible chuckle, but not, you know, not a laugh out loud, but
Is this pre or post Darwin? I don't know my dates on these things.
I don't remember. I mean, Darwin was like 1860s, I believe. So this is post.
So like, because the whole thing of this, like, so the idea is that the more sides you have, the higher class you are. But then they introduce this mechanic, and I think of it more as a mechanic in terms of games than in anything founded in any kind of reality of society or biology. And that subsequent generations of certain classes are born with more sides than the previous generation. But only after a certain threshold, because otherwise everything would always trend towards more and more sides, and you wouldn't have any low-sided things. So it was like the lower part of society doesn't follow that rule. These triangular working class people have other triangles and stuff. But every once in a while, they might have like an equilateral triangle, and that's a good one. And that one has a chance to break into the other realm. And in the other realm, every subsequent generation gives birth to children that have more sides than the previous one. And it accelerates so that if you're a many, many sided polygon, your kids might not have just one more side than you, but like 100 sides. So it's kind of a rich get richer, poor stay poor thing with a tiny membrane for social mobility, right? But it's based on biology, and not a biology, certainly not anything founded in science, but also not founded in any false understanding of science as far as I can tell. So like maybe it's just a biological geometric analogy for a societal thing, because there was no belief that like, you know, rich people give birth to people who will surely be richer and smarter than them. Like, I think, you know, especially in a country with a royal family, knows that that's not how heredity works, especially when you marry your sister.
I mean, the Victorians were this highly scientifically minded people, and they came out of a deeply held class structure in England, but they did believe in the, you know, one of the great myths, and please take this in the way that it's meant, in not a falsehood but a myth, in the sense of a foundational story that may or may not be true, but the belief in which is absolutely crucial to the society of capitalism, is upward mobility. And it's that belief that it's possible that makes people excuse all the horrible things that a classed society does. And I think we are meant to see the society of Flatland as absurd. The book makes this move from the self-satisfaction of the narrator, who is a flat square living on a flat plane in a flat world where everyone else around him appears as lines. That's the only thing you can see are lines and points, because that's the way geometry would work in two spaces, assuming one could see at all, if there was any mechanism for doing that. But he seems very satisfied with his existence, and he seems very satisfied with the social order. It's at the moment that he later realizes that there are other dimensions that he pulls himself out of that, and he sees in some ways how ridiculous this whole plain world that he's been living in is. But that's also that moment that the author, the Edward Abbott, is reaching out to the reader and inviting us to consider how self-satisfied we are with our own social order. And you know, maybe it doesn't work for you, but I do think there is this move towards trying to invite us to think that if someone can be so wrong about the fact that there is another dimension that's out there, that if you could perceive it, if you could move in it, your life would be infinitely better, and the possibilities for existence would increase infinitely. In the same way, your social structures might change. In the same way, your belief of in the completeness of your knowledge would change.
You could see all your neighbor's stuff. So let's get into the geometry aspect of it, because this is another part that hung me up a little bit as a nerd with a modern understanding of things. And they address it later in the book, and I feel like is, if not a fatal flaw in the choice of trying to use this analogy, it's a problematic one, right? In actual two dimensions, you can't see anything edge on, right? You can't. If there's anything that you can see, if there's anything that, for whatever definition of seeing, something for light to bounce off, there is no other dimension. You can't see anything. If you're on a 2D plane, looking out on a 2D plane, you can't see anything. But in this book, for the thing to work, you have to be able to see these lines. Much later in the book, when talking with another, with the sphere, it's like, well, of course, you do have a third dimension, but it's super small. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to see anything. It's like, yeah, that's what I've been thinking the whole time. And if they're going to have, here's the fundamental scientific problem, which they should have been able to deal with because of like Einstein and everything. This predates Einstein too, right?
This is pre-Einstein.
Yeah. But anyway, it's a two-dimensional, the thing that has dimensions is essentially the universe, right? And there's lots of, modern books you can read about why it is that perhaps our universe has three dimensions, why space and time work the way they do. There's, the famous pop culture book, Brief History of Time, actually has a two-dimensional section of it, which we'll get into in a second. So the idea that you can be in two dimensions, but that a third dimension exists, doesn't make any sense. Nor does the idea of seeing with any kind of light in two dimensions, because where is light? I mean, they gloss over it, like, here's where the light comes from, here's what north is, here's what south is, let's deal with gravity. But if there's anything for light to bounce off of, or light is coming from anywhere, there has to be a third dimension. And if there is any kind of third dimension, there's all of the third dimension. You can't have a fractional third dimension. But you can't have a story unless you do something much more clever about things living in 2D space, unless they can see each other or interact in some way. So they have to do sort of this half 2D, half 3D thing. They keep talking about mouths and eyes and stuff like that. So the Brief History of Time, what's his name? What's the author of that?
Stephen Hawking.
Stephen Hawking, yeah, right. He does the thing of and I think it's very facile and silly, but he does it. Why don't we have two dimensions? Well, you can't have anything with a digestive tract in two dimensions because you basically split the being down the middle because there is no way for anything to close around it. So the idea of having a mouth in two dimensions, where does that mouth lead? How does an eye work? Because there's no light and no things for it to bounce off of. And where does a mouth lead? You can't have a digestive tract in 2D. You just split yourself into two pieces that can never be joined again. It doesn't make any sense, which is why... life as we know it exists in three dimensions and it makes sense. And to conceive of something that could exist and interact with each other in two dimensions is very difficult, which is why I think one of the most interesting parts of the book is when he has the dream about one dimension, right? Which is still silly because there's still eyes and mouths and sound and all that doesn't make any sense in one dimension, makes even less sense in one dimension than it is in two. But in one dimension, at least, since they're all stuck on the line, if you concede that they can see anything at all, which again, doesn't make any sense, I feel like it is more constrained enough where you can say, I see what the limited world they live in. They're all along this line. You can only see your neighbor, and to communicate, they need some other mechanism because they can't see past the other one. And, anyway, it's got the same problems as the two dimension. And so the third dimension comes along. It's like, there's been a third dimension all along. Like, what are you picturing in your head? These things with eyes and mouths and sound and light that it can all see each other. That's not 2D and that's not 1D. It's like very, very short 3D. And so I get where they're going with the analogy and I get where they're going with the dimensions, but the problem is the author is stuck in three-dimensional thinking and frames the entire story in a series of miniaturized, limited three-dimensional scenarios because that's the only way the author can conceptualize how to tell a story. Otherwise, how can you have characters or interaction if you have fewer dimensions? And I feel like an actual, much more clever author would have found a way to tell the story. Because this author is stuck in three dimensions. The author cannot conceive of anything other than three dimensions. And so all the stories, both 2D and 1D, are in three dimensions, just writ small.
Well, maybe it will help you to think of it as Mario World 3D.
Yeah, it's the same type of thing, though. And it's the point of the book later is just in the same way they couldn't think of three dimensions, you might have trouble thinking of four. And if you can think of four, what about five and six and seven? It's like an interesting academic exercise, but it's clear that the author can only think in three dimensions and doesn't offer us any tools to think in anything other than three dimensions.
I think there's a wonderful passage towards the very end of this opening section, which again, the opening section does go on for about two-thirds of the book without any real narrative to speak of other than recounting history. There's a funny passage where he says that he's going to gloss over a bunch of things that readers would be interested in. He said, for example, our method for propelling and stopping ourselves, although destitute of feet, the means by which we give fixity to structures of wood, stone, or brick, although of course we have no hands, nor can we lay foundations as you can, nor avail ourselves of lateral pressure of the earth, the manner in which rain originates in the intervals between our various zones, so that the northern regions do not intercept the moisture from falling of the, on the southern. You know, it's funny. He's lampshading this whole thing. You know, he's saying,
but he's highlighting the fact that like they're all called humans, even though they're squares and stuff. They call themselves humans. They refer to wood and weather and foundations. It's nonsensical. Like, not only is he not going to tell us about it, and I don't think it's hanging a lantern. I'm just saying, look, I haven't really thought this through. Suffice it to say, we have all the same stuff that you have. Like, we're English, just like you are. We have trees and wood and rain. And we move around, even though we don't have feet, but we have mouths and eyes, and just it's 2D. Just go with it.
It's the same conceit as Mickey Mouse wearing kid gloves, you know.
But he's in 3D,
right? But I'm just saying that when characters just do things that don't exist organically in their universe, that happens quite frequently in these kinds of light fantasies. You know, people will make reference to, people will be anachronistic, people will make reference to things that there's no way they should know of them. It seems to me more like light fantasy, and I do agree that in some of the cases it's just him throwing up his hands and saying, look, I tried, I'm not really interested in that, because I don't think if you actually were going to write about, I don't think one could actually write a story that was going to be a realistic depiction of life in two dimensions. I don't think such a thing it would exist.
Well, I mean, you could, like, it would be, but it would be more of a scientific exploration. Like what you got it before, like the idea that this dimensionality is used as a tool to help you see things from a different perspective, haha, is fine, right. Well and good, but it's clear that the author did not have the world-building chops to actually pull that off, and actually it's one of the harder leaps to make, because most world-building is like, well, imagine there's a bunch of little people, like Gulliver's Travels, or imagine there was a talking cat and a weird guy with a hat and tea, and like, you can do all sorts of wacky things. You're not taking a dimension away from space, or try writing a story about a world without time. Like, it's very difficult. So choosing this as your sort of analogy for your satire or whatever, it's a high degree of difficulty, and he absolutely did not pull it off. Like, if you're willing to kind of go with it and go la-di-da, fine, but it's so difficult to do and so sort of poorly conceived. There is no cleverness where you're like, I didn't think they'd be able to make that make sense, but they did. No, none of it makes any sense. Like, you just kind of go, okay, I kind of see what you're doing, and I see how, if you haven't thought about how planes intersect 3D shapes, this might be kind of interesting. But like, at every second my brain was saying, but they wouldn't be able to see anything. It doesn't make any sense. How are they talking? How is there any light? It doesn't make any sense. And so at that point, when they try to say, and think about four dimensions, I'm like, no, F you, I'm not thinking about four dimensions. You haven't even been able to handle one or two. You're just totally 3D.
I'm a little bit befuddled here, because I keep wondering, do you watch Bugs Bunny cartoons and keep saying to yourself, rabbits don't actually eat carrots?
But like, it doesn't take away, like, those characters are all in 3D. It doesn't take away a dimension. Even in a 2D thing, it's clearly a representation of a 3D world, but this thing hinges so much on, let me describe what it might be like to be 2D. Isn't it such a weird alien world? It's like, it would be, but that's not what you're describing. You're describing really short people, really short shapes. Like, I can go with that, but the idea that there's a dimension that they don't know about, that they can't look up or down with their supposed eyes, with light that's bouncing all over the place off the edges of things that are not 2D but are in fact 3D but very short, like, it doesn't track on the scientific
perhaps,
level.
Perhaps, but I do think that when the third dimensional character visits, finally, when we get what little plot this book does have, a sphere appears over Flatland, and we have these depictions of what it means for a three-dimensional object to try and communicate to a plane while hovering above it. They can't see it. The square thinks that the voice is coming from inside himself, or inside from some
in his stomach. The stomach is the way to refer to anything inside, which is very, very quaint. They can still hear it, obviously, because the sound in the 3D space that they all exist in is bouncing all over the place, but they can't look up. It's like dogs, they can't look up.
And then the sphere tries to interact with Flatland by passing through it, producing a series of circles that appear and disappear, and eventually the square is hoisted out of Flatland and into the third dimension, is able to look down on Flatland and see for the first time from another dimension. Now, whether or not the depiction of two dimensions has been successful up to this point, this is really what the book is leading up to. At that point, the square is able to see something of the absurdity of his world, and he's able to see...
He can see the Matrix.
Right, he can see the limitations that he's been living in, and he can see the possibilities that another dimension opens up to him. And that's why when he, in turn, asks the sphere to take him into the next dimension so he can look down into the sphere's insides, and the sphere gets all grumpy and harumphy and says, "No, I have all the truth." Yeah. That's the point there. I mean,
yeah,
that is
no,
the point
I see where they're going with that, but like again, getting hung up on the math thing. It's like you can see inside the sphere. That's what being 3D means. You can pass right and see. In fact, you can see inside 2D things too. When a woman pierces you, she's seeing your inside. Like if, in that analogy, like I know what they're getting for the higher dimension, and I get the idea that the sphere can conceptualize, and you know, it's trying to make the reader think, "Ha, you've been feeling so superior at this point." But then we get into the 3D one, you realize you can't conceive of the higher ones either. And what would that even be like? Math has answers to those questions, by the way. It's still difficult to conceive, but it's not ridiculous. One more mathematical thing that the sphere encounter highlights, the poor quality world building, right? So in the two-dimensional thing, the more sides you have, the higher class, and the highest class have so many sides that they just call themselves circle, even though they're just a series of line segments, right? But the higher class you are, the smoother your circle is, and the more, you know, it's impossible to see how many sides because they're all kind of shaded the same with the wave, blah, blah, blah. Anyway. But so when the sphere and the sphere encounter, our narrator is like, and you know, comes up and feels the sphere, and it's like, oh my god, this thing, like there are no angles, it's a completely smooth curve. You can have completely smooth curves in 2D space too. This limitation that you've put, that there's only polygons and lines, is not a limitation of 2D. It's just a part of your world that makes no sense. So you shouldn't be super impressed by an intersection of a sphere with your supposed 2D space because it's smooth, because you should be able to have circles and curves and other kind of lines. And I don't know, is it just because they didn't have, like it doesn't, it's part of the world as established, but there is nothing about 3D that says you can have an actual circle versus 2D. You can have an actual sphere and you can have an actual circle in 2D. And it's a limitation that doesn't make any sense mathematically and is meant to be revelatory, to say not only is this 3D thing able to see the dimension, but also it's perfectly smooth. It's the ideal that could never be realized in your space, but here realized, and also in an additional dimension.
Well, so was there anything about this book that you found agreeable or revelatory, or that you have to give a little bit of credit to?
I actually liked, despite the fact that I couldn't tell which parts were supposed to be satirical and which parts were supposed to be, you know, the sort of foundation, I liked the idea of the women being lines and being deadly and a society being built around, like, there's been a lot of science fiction stories that are similar to this, where some biological fact of some alien life necessitates a sort of, or like leads to an oppressive culture. I mean, arguably that's what happens with humans too, but like the idea that women are like actually deadly. If you walk into one, you die, right? And so an entire society is built around the idea of how can we safely live with women. Like maybe we were like, I don't know, praying mantises where the women like mate and then kill you, or the males all die after mating, or like a society of intelligent beings who are biologically have this kind of, you know, problematic interaction. Like as soon as the males mate, they die, or the women kill during mating, or if you bump into a woman, you die. What kind of society of intelligent beings would you build around that? The idea of a peace cry, separate doors for the women, that you can't see them edge on, that they, if they revolt, you're in big trouble because you can't see them and they can kill you instantly, and you could have them all lined up and you can walk into them, like their use in warfare. The idea of not educating them because they'd be too deadly, but you need them for reproduction, which, by the way, how does reproduction work in this world? They don't get into that either. That I find the most interesting aspect. The geometric parts of it don't matter, but I was saying, imagine these are aliens. You could do a good sci-fi story of, you know, a race of beings that achieve intelligence, these alien beings that achieve intelligence, but they haven't escaped their biological essential nature, and their biological essential nature is really weird from the perspective of people, and so their entire society is really real, but it's like, but it's got to be this way, otherwise we'd all be dying when we walk down the street because we wouldn't be able to see the women coming, and they would, you know, obviously the line on it. That actually is the most interesting aspect of this story, as long as I pretend it's not geometry.
It's a really weird set of implications to the women being lions. One of them being that the women develop a sort of a waggle that they walk around with, so that mm-hmm. they can never fully be seen head on, you know, so that you will always see
them. It's a polite waggle, yeah.
Right, this polite waggle. And there's a funny part where he discusses how this has become seen as, like he says here, it is considered a disgrace to any state that legislation should have to enforce what ought to be and is in every respected female a natural instinct. And mm-hmm. it's this funny moment where you're kind of saying, now what is he saying here? Because it reminds me, the reader, of the idea of swaying feminine hips mm-hmm. and whether or not that's a cultural determination or biological determination. It feels like Abbott is on the verge of something interesting about gender here, but mm-hmm. not quite there. He just doesn't have whatever. He doesn't have the background or the interest to just push it over into something really interesting and weird. And as you say, a lot more could be done with the idea of a society in which there actually is deadly antagonism between the sexes and what
or
that
not,
means.
Not antagonism, but just like, you know, accidental death through no fault. Like, if you're not careful, this would happen. And so because we're smart, we have to build structures so that people don't accidentally die. Right, that they're, you know, women are poisonous if you touch them, right? Or like for certain times of the year, so they have to wear certain clothing, right? And that type of story, which again doesn't take anything on in dimensions, but just purely does it with aliens, typical sci-fi story, could be a way, and probably people have written this exact story, to shed light on how the biological differences between actual men and women have led to the oppressive society, you know, the society that we have now, where women are oppressed for reasons related to the biology and like are kept in that box to say, well, this has to be this way because X and Y supposed biological realities, and you build all these structures to, you know, like that's the sci-fi story I saw and was interested in lurking in this thing. The geometrical stuff I'm actually interested in, but this book offered no help in how one might imagine higher dimensions or how they might exist. It didn't introduce a fourth dimensional thing. It did such a bad job of drawing the one and two dimensional that you get, you know, the three, and then but they don't go farther with the four. So if the only point is everyone thinks they see the whole picture, but they don't really, you could have got that done in, like, you know, three pages. Like, we don't need 115 pages.
Friend of the show, Glenn Fleischman, pointed out that there is a contemporary sequel to Flatland called Flatterland by Ian Stewart, which is actually written by a mathematician and who expounds upon the basis of this book following the, I guess, the great-great-granddaughter of the square in this book, and goes on to explain things like string theory and contemporary mathematical and physics understandings of higher dimensions. And maybe you'd be happier reading that book, I guess.
As long as it's not too long. I'm looking at some of my highlights, and here's another puzzler, and the reason I highlighted it. I think this is just an attempt at humor, but I think it also possibly reflects a attribute of the society in which the book was written that we find barbaric today. This is in one of those charitably described lamp hanging, but less charitably described as completely punting passages, where they're like, you know, what is the origin of light? You know, a question that the denizens of Flatland have, right? And the author says, the solution has been repeatedly attempted with no other result than to crowd our lunatic asylums with would-be solvers. The idea that if you were to ponder questions of science, the mere pondering of them would cause you to be framed a lunatic and put into an asylum, which in the end is basically what happens to the square, because he tries to tell everyone about the third dimension. And it's almost framed as like, haha, you know, you'd go in the loony bin, right? Today, we tend not to think that if you have an interesting or weird idea about science, we put you in an asylum. And the asylums weren't very pleasant then. So it was understood that basically, like, we remove you from society if you say something against the orthodoxy. That does not happen today and is generally frowned upon.
I will defend Abbott on this because I do think that we are supposed to see, you know, the square's eventual institutionalization as being not a good thing. And then,
yeah, I mean, they're far enough away from Galileo that they're able to look there down their nose at that and say, wasn't it terrible that when you had an idea that went against the church, we would kill
look,
you?
just a few episodes ago in Sophomore Lit, we did the Yellow Wallpaper, which is a story about a woman being put on what was called the rest cure, which was a popular Victorian thing to do. If people started thinking too much, if women started thinking too much, put them in bed and lock them up and they'll stop thinking. I was pointing out on the Facebook group for Sophomore Lit that this book always struck me as being unadaptable, and apparently it's been adapted into video form at least 3 times.
I would imagine. Very loosely.
Well, the first one, this like 1960s animated thing, seems like it's the one that is the closest like it. And it feels like a UPA cartoon, like that very kind of arch humor, very ironic humor.
Yeah, the 60s and with animation is the right combination of time period and medium to attempt this.
But there was very recently an adaptation of this, like in, 2000. Actually, there were two adaptations of it in 2007. I'll look it up in IMDb. Yeah, here we go. It had Martin Sheen, Kristen Bell, Michael York.
Narrating or
playing characters in this? Apparently, like, they added characters to it. Yeah, there was Martin Sheen plays the square. Kristen Bell plays a new character called Hex. I guess that Michael York is the sphere. Tony Hale is in it.
This is not a fertile ground for adaptation. People should just leave this alone. Of all the things to try, I mean, I guess it's public domain, so it's got that going for it. Another thing, I'm looking over my notes some more. Another thing that is in this the world that they build a lot, but not remarked on really. I mean, presumably we're supposed to be horrified by it, but it is never remarked upon. Is the copious use of genocide as a tool of social order? They're constantly consuming or destroying any sort of shape or class of shape or huge groups of shape that disturbs the social order in any way. It's just like, oh, we consumed them. They were all destroyed. There are these huge battles that kill seemingly vast portions of their population. But like, if there's any trouble from the working class, like, we have them all destroyed. Like this, reading one of the rule things, any female duly certified to be suffering from St. Vitus's dance, fits, chronic cold, accompanied by violent sneezing, or any disease necessitating involuntary emotions shall be instantly destroyed. So if you get a cold, they'll just immediately kill you too, because you're a danger to the men involved. But, and that's just a minor case of like, yeah, you know, if you're a little bit shaky, we'll just kill you. Also, if there's any kind of uprising or discontent, we'll have them all destroyed. And if any of these lower class people hear some information not to hear, of course, they'll be consumed. So the information doesn't leak out. And it's that matter of factly, and presumably, you know, the author was also frowning on genocide, but I'm surprised at how heavily it features into the world. And like, there's another thing they didn't do a good job of establishing is what does it take to be killed? Supposedly they're pierced and they're killed, but like, what causes a line to pierce and not, you know, the tip of a triangle? How pointy does it have to be? What are the things made out of? Like, it's just, I know they just want to lay down the rules and just let you accept it and say, here are the rules. I'm just going to spend 2/3 of the book telling you the rules, but it's very difficult to, it's like Doctor Who or any other story. Like, you really need to establish an understandable, plausible set of rules before you can have drama within that world. This thing establishes a lot of rules, but they don't really make any sense, and they aren't used to establish much drama, because the events of the sphere happen very quickly, and then the thing is over. Although I do like that the entire encounter happens in 1999, so you know the fantastical far future of Flatland is when they roll over from 1999 to 2000. Inconceivable from the 1800s.
If it makes you feel any better, John, none of this happened.
Didn't it, John? Didn't it?
but the one thing that we did get out of this is that one episode of Futurama.
That's true. And there was a Simpsons. Wasn't there a Simpsons episode, too?
Was there a Simpsons episode?
There was one where Homer goes into like a weird 3D plane thing, and I think he's 2D at some point. It's vague.
Glad to have you back on the show. Sorry, it was so painful. And
they can't all be winners.
Thank you for doing the reading, because as sophomore lit listeners know, participation is 9/10 of the grade.
Yeah, it should be.
Thanks to my co-host, John Siracusa. You can hear him lots of places, but his current podcasts are The Accidental Tech Podcast, Robot or Not, and Reconcilable Differences. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. Write to the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. Join the discussion on Facebook, or look for us on the Incomparable membership Slack. I hope your summer vacation's going well, sophomores, but remember to keep up the reading, because everything will be on the final.
Sure. Well, this, I can't figure out this Kindle. This aren't all the notes that I took. This doesn't have all my notes. As they wax in their mental abilities necessary to employ their tremendous penetrating power to advantage, so do they wane in the power of the penetration itself. God, look at this author. I guess everyone wrote like that in Victorian times. I'm not a fast reader anyway, but it was so slow, and I kept looking at the progress bar. I'm like, when does this end?